Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
You should grunt really, really hard on your drop shots. Your opponent will anticipate you're hitting it really deep and really hard, and you should not grunt at all when you do hit the ball as hard as possible.
Welcome all, it is episode 65 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is Tim Wigmore. Tim covers cricket for The Telegraph and has also co-written a new book called The Best, How Elite Athletes Are Made. That book delves into the characteristics of the best athletes on the planet and investigates the circumstances and the environments in which said elite athletes are produced. It is a fascinating book, so let's get on with this conversation with Tim Wigmore. Tim, what's the crack? How are you getting on?
Yeah, all pretty good here in gloomy London, but yeah, not too bad. Cheers, Gavin.
Yeah, it's pretty gloomy everywhere at the moment. I know the sun is out here, but the mood is still fairly gloomy. But look, we'll lift it, I'm sure, with this conversation. So your book is excellent, The Best, How Elite Athletes Are Made. Tim, was there any kind of thesis that you were trying to prove or disprove in writing it, or was there another motivation for it?
Thanks very much. Yeah, so the idea was, so this was a collaboration with Professor Mark Williams, who's basically spent his whole lifetime kind of researching elite athletes, what goes into making them, what is it that they do, how do you kind of deconstruct that? But our thesis, there wasn't really a broad thesis in that we kind of wanted to show a kind of a nuanced 360 degree the journey of what it takes to become an elite athlete. So this is very much not a kind of one size fits all book. If you do these 10 things, you will become an elite athlete. But it's looking at all of the factors that go into becoming elite, from the kind of luck of birth into how athletes adapt and what they do. And hopefully there's some tips that can make all of us a little bit better along the way.
What was your single most surprising discovery?
Surprising? I mean, the advantage for younger siblings, I had no idea about that. And that was a huge, and it's really statistically a really, really big advantage. So that's basically any family with two kids, the younger one statistically has much more chance of becoming an elite athlete. And even when they both become professional, the younger one is better in about 2 out of 3 cases. So obviously there's lots of exceptions to this, but that's statistically a very, very powerful trend. And that, it's worth thinking about why that's the case. Because obviously the genes are first and second sibling. There's not going to be a gene difference that's significant that explains that. So that is a product of their environment. And basically, if you're a younger sibling, well, you have that kind of competitiveness that's drilled into you from trying to keep up with your older siblings. It's actually much better for your skill development if you play up. And basically, the research on this is that if you fail more and you're constantly challenged by stuff that's very difficult for you and out of your comfort zone, that's actually a lot better for you than if you're in the big brother or big sister position where you kind of win most of the time and you don't need to be pushed in the same way. And also younger siblings tend to have more informal play, probably because parents are often a bit more relaxed with younger siblings. And, you know, the older one sometimes looks after the younger one as well, which means the young one gets more informal play, which is really good for skill development, for making athletes kind of think for themselves better, take more ownership over their learning and stuff. So lots of advantages for younger siblings. I mean, a classic case study would probably be the Williams sisters, where their father, Richard, always said Serena would go on to be the better one. And actually, if you look at photos of them when they're 7 and 8, so Serena was 15 months younger. And actually that Venus was sort of like 3 inches taller, which you kind of take a step back. Obviously, she'd generally been taller for their whole kind of journey as kids. So Serena basically had all this disadvantage. She was probably not going to be as fast. So she had to make up for in other ways through skills and tactics. And then she reaches a point where she's not at a physical disadvantage and she's had to learn all those other skills, and that give her the advantage.
And it also, Tim, I think the younger sibling also learns a kind of a tenacity, or they do seem to hate losing more. That definitely seemed to be a trend that you identified in the book that probably began with, I cannot lose my big sister or big brother here. And they then brought that into their pro careers.
That's right. So we talked with Judy Murray, and she said about Andy, you know, all he ever wanted to do was beat Jamie. So that was that competitiveness that was drilled into Andy. Andy was 2 months younger, two years older than Jamie. And so, yeah, it's that was a real, real motivating factor. And it often is. And it's actually kind of more of a motivating factor to want to beat someone than not want to lose to them. It's a kind of negative way. So that again helps to explain the advantage for younger siblings.
One of the reasons I really did like this book is that it didn't make me feel so bad about my failed sports career. Now, granted, like my total lack of talent and allergy to hard work and dedication meant it was unlikely to happen anyway, but I am the elder sibling, or eldest sibling.
I'm an only child, and that's my reason for writing about sport rather than playing it.
Oh, is there research on, is an only child less likely to make it as an elite than a child who has younger siblings?
Yeah, it does seem like being an only child is truly the worst of all worlds, because you don't have that. You don't have someone to play with who's better than you or worse than you. You just have to play by yourself, which is not nearly as good.
I am also from the country and not from a mid-sized town, which your book reveals is a disadvantage for me.
So you're from a country, a very small town in the country.
Yeah, sorry, rural Ireland with, you know, no one but my sister around me for miles.
And she's younger than you, so it's not even very good to play against her. Yeah, so that's another, there's this town in Australia called Wagga Wagga, which is about halfway between Melbourne and Sydney. And it's a town of 50,000 people, and it's produced a huge number of elite athletes. And a kind of local fable has it, there's something in the water, some special sort of nutrients which give kids, you know, sporting prowess. Obviously, that's not the case, but the reason so many athletes from Wagga Wagga come, and from mid-sized towns in general, basically, is they are the best of all worlds. So you have the kind of quality of coaching, quality of facilities, amount of competition that you would get in big cities, and you also have just the space, the culture of informal play that you get in smaller areas. So you have this kind of it's a sweet spot, but basically, so you have all the things that you need to get better and improve, but it's also just so easy to play. And one of the big things, of course, if you're in a big city, generally you can have to travel a lot of time between fixtures and even to get to training and stuff, which is time that you could be spent playing. So in Wagga Wagga, basically everything is so close, and there's a really good, vibrant culture of sport, but everything's also close that you can just spend all day playing. And again, parents are more relaxed as well, because it's that kind of community feel. So you don't get the kind of nervousness of parents, which you get in cities sometimes about letting their kids play unsupervised. So yeah, that's why you get a lot more athletes from these mid-sized areas.
And the final fact working against me in this cosmic joke of my sports career was the fact that I was born in April, which meant I am late in the selection year for soccer in Ireland, because it runs from September through to, you know, the following August, which meant I was on the receiving end of the relative age effect. Can you, Tim, maybe tease out what that means and how it impacts people?
Yeah, it's the relative age effect is the impact of when you're born on your chance of becoming an elite athlete. But this works in two ways. I'll explain that the first. So the first is basically that if you are young for your selection year, so you're a late birth for your school year, you have significantly less chance of getting into academies and also less chance of becoming a professional athlete at the end of the day. And this is basically because, you know, when if you're comparing a kid born in September to one born July or August in the same year, well, you know, if they're 10, the one in September will be 10% older. So they're likely to be bigger, stronger, faster, and just have more hours to develop as well. So coaches will generally pick the older kid, even if the younger one actually might have a bit more skill. And this is actually famously what led Arsenal to release Harry Kane aged 8. This is quite painful for me as an Arsenal fan. But Harry Kane born at the end of July. And according to Liam Brady, one of Ireland's finest, but not when it comes to talent spotting, it would seem, he was a bit chubby. He wasn't very athletic. So they decided to release Harry Kane. The rest is painful history from my point of view. But the point is, if you are young for your year, it's a lot harder to get into the system. So at some points, there's been four times more Premier League academy players born from September to November than in the last three months of the school year. So a big advantage there. So that is the relative age effect. But there's also an odd kink here, which Harry Kane himself exemplifies, which basically is that although you have fewer pro athletes who are born young for the year, you have slightly more super elite players who are young for the year. So, you know, majority of MVPs across sports are actually born in the last months of the year. And that's basically, it's a little bit like the sibling effect. So basically it's like, if you're Harry Kane, as we've seen with him, he was released even. So, but you have a system there that's basically it wants to get rid of you at every turn because you don't fit the mold. But if you can come out, cling on into and stay in the system for as long as possible, that means that you're playing up the whole time. You're forced to develop in different ways. And then when you do physically develop and you don't have that physical disadvantage anymore, you've been forced to develop the tenacity, the skills, the tactics, which gives you an edge. So it's a bit of a failure in talent development, which creates these odd effects at both sides of the equation.
Yeah, so I mean, the sibling effect and your location, they're almost kind of intrinsic issues, but I mean, the relative age effect is an extrinsic issue. It's to do with talent spotting and academies and pathways. So there's particularly like Premier League football academies, because you mentioned the Premier League, there's so much money in that business and there's such a desperation to spot talent. In what ways are clubs trying to counter the relative age effect, or have they been trying to do that?
So West Brom recently did a trial specifically for kids born in the last 3 months of the school year. So it was a sort of a trial of the discards and the unwanted, which is not a bad thing to do to try and kind of correct yourself. But we're seeing New Zealand in rugby are probably the case study in this. So they group players together based on weight as opposed to age. And that's a really good method because it helps kids, you know, challenges kids in different ways. Because actually you want to challenge the kid who's born early in the school year and is very big and fast. So you actually want to challenge him. So he has to develop different skills as well. So the ways teams can try and fight against that is some very simple methods, such as actually playing everyone in a team based on their age, not their school year. So you have a team of 10-year-olds, which means if Jimmy or Jill are born in August, they will start as youngest in that team, and then all their teammates will go off into the under-11s teams, and then they will eventually be the oldest in their team. And that's quite good because it means all kids get the same opportunity to be the oldest in their team and the youngest. And that's quite a nice method. But some teams, I think in Belgium, some academies are very explicitly almost across the system saying, you know, we will have at least 40% of our players born in the last 6 months of the year and so on. All of those are quite, you obviously don't want to be too rigid because you can just have random years where you get way more talent that's born in certain months. But it's kind of good to be aware of these things. And then I think it's about asking the right question. Is the kid born in October really that much better than the kid born in July, or are they just a bit more developed?
Yeah. The subject of talent spotting, you mentioned Belgium there, and one of the most startling things I found in the book was a football club in Belgium signed a 20-month-old child based off the quality of his first touch. Like, and Man City have an academy for under fives. Like, I do kind of wonder about the morals of, you know, introducing kids that young. Like, I mean, 20 months old is nuts into an elite sporting environment. Like, I remember a couple of months ago, there was a story on the Liverpool Echo website of a video of a six-year-old at Liverpool's academy, which kind of went viral. And I'm thinking, I don't know. I mean, I think maybe the super club, super academy system has gone badly wrong if a six-year-old is making headlines, you know? So where do you... I suppose that feeds into the debate about early specialisation. I know it's a very fraught debate as to what age the kids should really be brought into what is an effective professional sports environment and start practicing, like dedicating an amount of time commensurate to that environment. So what was your finding on early specialization? Is there an age at which it's best to introduce kids to the particular sport that they may become elite at?
So in terms of specialization, what we know is that if you specialise earlier, you're more likely to suffer from burnout, more likely to drop out early from the sport, more likely to suffer from overuse injury, and just to fall out of love with the sport. So these are all real negatives against specialising too early. But the flip of that is if you don't do enough time on what becomes your sport, that can be a disadvantage. And that's especially true in a sport like football or basketball, which is, you know, a huge amount of people play those sports across the world. And the skill of those sports is bigger than a sport like in rowing. So we talked with Helen Glover, who didn't actually get in a rowing boat till the age of 21. And she went on to win two Olympic medals. Thing about rowing is that that depends a lot on your physical, your physique and your capabilities there. And the kind of tactical dimension, although there is one, it's less, which means you don't need to do as many. Often you don't need to do as many hours. And so she wins a gold medal after 4,000 hours, which is showing that the 10,000 hour rule, yeah, you don't need to do 10,000 hours to be elite. It's neither necessary nor sufficient. And it seems to me like the best, and from Mark's research, like the best way out of this sort of riddle is what's called the early engagement model, which is that, you know, if you go on to be a top player in football, generally you would have started playing football at a young age, and you've done a lot of hours of playing football, but you know, so potentially from the age of 4 or 5 often, but you wouldn't have actually specialized till the age of, you know, mid late teens, 16 or so. So you basically kind of keep sport as a fun thing to do. You do a lot of it, but you don't have the idea that you can't do other things. I think there's actually real dangers with treating a 10-year-old kind of like their professional athlete, because they will burn out. You cannot kind of train and think like a pro athlete for potentially 25 years, you know, from the age of 10 to 35. So this early engagement model seems to be sort of scientifically and morally probably the best way out of this conundrum.
The other thing that really grabbed me about the book, Tim, is that it's very hard to manufacture an elite athlete, really, particularly at sports, very dynamic sports like football, for instance, or rugby union, or even perhaps tennis, you know, sports that demand a lot of different skills and techniques at the same time, that are less kind of numbers based and physicality based than, you know, the long jump or something like that, those Olympic sports. And what seems to be crucial, and one of the themes that links a lot of what you've talked about there and other things in the book, is informal play and learning almost kind of by yourself. Is that fair? And in what are there any sporting structures out there that kind of rely on informal play and try to replicate it within formal structures?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's really important to remember, you know, we're in an age of kind of hyper-industrialized academies and talent development system. And yet informal play is so, so important. So yeah, for the book, I visited the Bonleur in Paris, which produces, you know, a huge amount of elite footballers. And these basically come through a system of street football, which is incredibly vibrant, very competitive games, often very small-sided as well. And you get players from all age groups competing against each other. And these are incredibly good for developing players. And the reason they are so good is games of street football, you know, formal play in general, they help develop kind of self-managing athletes, you know, athletes who learn how to diagnose and correct problems instantly, athletes who can generate their own feedback rather than relying on, you know, their teacher or their parent to tell them how they should play. And they're exposed to a huge amount of different variables. So if you have a dodgy pitch, actually, that can be really good at a, you know, young age, because that's, you have to develop a trick to cope with that or something. And actually not having a referee. So we talked with those who used to play with Riyad Mahrez as a kid, and he was always very, very small and skinny as a kid. And, you know, you don't really get referees in street football. So he had to find ways of coping, you know, without a referee. And I think that the kind of math is also very important, which is a simple, if you play street football, you know, 3 or 4 a side, you're going to get a lot more touches of the ball, and it's really, really intensive than if you're playing 11 a side. So this is another argument actually in favor of small sided games. But this is not just, and so that was basically a study of Premier League academies, and they looked at players who are released age 16 and players who are offered 3-year scholarships at the same age. And they found that these two groups, you know, we'd like to think that the ones who offer scholarships are just trained harder and stuff, but it turns out this wasn't true at all. And the two groups have done exactly the same amount of training within the academy ground. So, you know, from that part of the history, there was no difference at all. But the important difference that the study found was that the players who were offered scholarships had done an average of 9 hours of street football a week, and the ones who weren't, only 5 hours. So we see this, yeah, being really, really important. Actually, lots of kind of the best young players in England now, you know, they're the best example. They're a great example of that. So with Jadon Sancho, he played and he talks about, you know, how street football means you fear no one because you've nothing to lose and you're just being yourself. Phil Foden, you know, in fact, he still goes back and plays some street football in Stockport as well. So it's incredibly powerful as a tool, and it's not only in football. You know, the NBA have done studies and they found that kids who play more pickup basketball, they become smarter learners who are better at adapting as well. So this really applies across the board. I think it's a really important kind of lesson for talent developers to sort of think about. How can they encourage kids to be creative and get that informal play and kind of ownership about their own skills? And kind of perversely, but not a bad idea, we're seeing some Premier League academies now doing cage football, which is kind of unsupervised. So they're almost trying to kind of artificially create informal play and street sport within the academies.
And by doing that, are they not talking themselves into their own obsolescence?
That's right. But in a sense, they are. I mean, coaching is still important. It's still important, you know, for everybody. But I think generally we overrate the importance of coaching and we underrate the importance of informal play. And we probably need to rebalance that a little bit. But in terms of what you said about, you know, talking their way out of a job, you know, one of the really interesting studies from the research in the book is that for athletes to develop, so not just as kids, but at all ages, less feedback is actually much better for them than more feedback. And here you have a real sort of tension because, you know, the team loses a game, a coach wants to feel useful, wants to kind of shout at the players or, you know, just talk a lot at them. But actually less feedback, which encourages them to take more ownership, is a lot better for coaches, a lot better for athletes. And actually with Judy Murray, we talked about, you know, her style with Jamie and Andy. And she said that she would avoid telling them kind of this is why you lost, and much more be framed around asking questions. So, you know, are there things you could have done better? What went wrong in the second set? That's a much better way of coaching because it encourages kids to take ownership and think for themselves than just saying you lost because your backhand was rubbish or whatever.
Well, we've talked about lots of sports there, Tim, but not really cricket, which is your beat. So that brings us on to the first year picks for us today. An essay about Brian Lara by Rahul Bhattacharya. I hope I'm pronouncing that name right. It appeared in the Cricket Monthly for ESPN. Can you tell us a little bit about this piece, Tim, and why you picked it for us?
Yeah, so it's an amazing article about how Brian Lara was in a real kind of rut in his career, and then he sort of turns to sports psychologist who gives him some tools in visualizing, and he basically manages to play this amazing innings before he plays it in real life, and it's, you know, Rahul's an incredible writer as well, and it's also great when you have a story that you think everyone knows, and then a writer kind of comes to it fresh. You know, this was 15 years after the innings, and finds a whole different dimension to it. I think that's something great in journalism when you can do that. You can help readers see a familiar story in a whole different way.
Yeah, the intro is absolutely great. I think it might have borrowed a little bit from Lolita, but Lara is a beautiful name, rhythmic, small, and epic. It is a classic film theme, an animated heroine, and in cricket, it is a poem that sings like a song, which I absolutely loved. So it was, I mean, this really did break down the method behind the genius in that visualization helped Brian Lara to fly effectively.
Yeah, and the impact of Michael Jordan. You know, he was given a book in which Michael Jordan talked about his visualization as well. That was a really, really nice part of it. Yeah, but the quality of writing as well, the way it kind of captures the atmosphere in the Caribbean, you know, around that moment as well. Yeah, some amazing writing.
Talk to me about visualization. What did you learn about the importance of that and how to do it effectively when you're writing the best?
Visualization is a really important tool for athletes. We talked with Dan Carter about his approach, you know, before taking a penalty, and he'd always would visualize the ball going over. And actually, as part of that, he would pick out a particular spot in the crowd and kind of be aiming for that, which was nice as well. The visualization, basically, it's been shown, if done properly, to give athletes more confidence, and with more confidence, that then in turn helps their performance as well.
Yeah. Is there ever a line between visualization and delusion? You know, I mean, I'm sure athletes don't want to, you know, start dreaming and getting ahead of themselves as regards what's ahead of them.
What, so you almost feel like you've done it before you have?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but I think there is something in that. It can then make the game, the moment and the pressure in the game seem familiar in a way. Visualization can actually, it can recruit senses, you know, sight, sound, smell and touch, and basically builds a kind of a movie of what's going to happen like before the game. And that just makes the moment seem familiar and kind of doesn't feel novel and scary, which just helps to kind of ground the athlete and focus on the process rather than, you know, the moment of, you know, bloody hell, this is a really big kick or whatever.
Yeah, and the process is what's important, isn't it? Because you address this under what's called the quiet eye.
Yeah, absolutely. So probably the best illustration of this is Annika Sorenstam. So she talks about how under pressure, she always had this urge to rush, because it's kind of like you have a really big shot. You have that kind of nervous energy. You almost maybe you want to get out of the way as well, which is kind of like if it's bad, at least it's over quickly. And she said she fought against this by having a routine of 24 seconds, which she stuck to before every single shot, and that every putt. And that was a way of kind of, yeah, focusing on the process, not getting caught up and carried in the moment, and not rushing. And the quiet eye part of that is that in static situations, so taking a, you know, a penalty kick in rugby or football or a putt on the golf course, elite athletes use their eyes differently to the rest of us. So they maintain a sharper focus on a specific point, i.e. where they want to hit the ball, and the rest of us kind of flit our eyes around a bit more, in a bit more of a kind of aimless way. And that quiet eye is really important, with the sort of the Dan Carter penalty is a good example of that. And also the rushing is part of that as well. So great study of penalties, lots of studies on penalty shootouts, which we actually have a chapter on in the book, is that when players take a shot within a second of the referee blowing their whistle, they're much more likely to miss their penalty. And a great example of this is Gareth Southgate in Euro 96, when the referee blows his whistle and he runs up immediately, and obviously it's saved. And he talks about later, he kind of wants to get that moment out of the way as quickly as possible. So again, for penalty shootouts, really, really good advice is just, yeah, having a process which you stick to at all times, and avoiding that temptation to rush, because yeah, rushing is a real pitfall, as England have learned better than anyone.
I was just gonna say the line that's always used is, well, you can practice penalties, but you can never replicate the pressure of the shootout, and I think that's true to a point, but particularly in England's case, they could have tried a bit harder. Like, as you outline in the book, you know, like Southgate, from his own experience, and because he's a smart and inquisitive dude, like he had, when they practiced penalties at the end of training, they did stand on the halfway line and they did get the ball and walk up as you would in a match. Whereas previously, when Southgate was a player, it was literally just line up on the edge of the box and kick a few penalties. You know, it was, they're practicing penalties, but not penalty shootouts.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the penalty shootout versus penalties is such an important point. So even in that penalty shootout against Colombia, which England won to kind of break the curse, or we saw with Jordan Pickford, he would like hand the ball to players. And that was identified as a really important moment as well, because it was seen that players could get really nervous and kind of not be sure what to do with the ball. You know, before, you know, and they were going up to the the penalty spot. So it's a way of kind of taking out these pressure moments. And this idea you can't prepare is really rubbish. Like, you can't completely replicate the pressure, absolutely not. But it's like if you're doing an exam, if you're a kid, like, of course you're going to do, you know, pass papers under the same time. Like, that's an obvious thing to do. And that means it's a little bit more familiar. It's not the same as the exam itself, but it makes the exam like a lot less difficult if you've done that preparation before. And that's what Southgate recognized. England, actually, they read all the research on penalty shootouts, and they looked at this so methodically. And we talked with Geir Jourday, who's kind of world expert on this. He now thinks England, having been kind of in the dark ages on penalties, they now have more cutting edge knowledge than any other team. So maybe we'll see him win a few more shootouts in the years ahead.
How did they get, like, how did successive England managers get away with, you know, just basically not doing their work on penalty shootouts and just saying, well, you know, it's impossible to replicate it, so we're not even going to try, and then we can lose and we can blame some kind of cosmic force acting against us. I can't understand how it was so anti-intellectual or lazy about it until Southgate got the job.
It's definitely all those things. There's also a kind of like defensiveness there, because if you fail and you call it a lottery, that's kind of like you've given yourself that kind of comfort blanket. Whereas I think if you're seen as doing all this research and stuff and then you lose anyway, it's like, well, I told you it wouldn't make any difference, mate. You should have been practicing other things and you wouldn't have got to a penalty shootout. So it's there. Yeah. There's some defensiveness here, but the anti-selection is spot on. And we talked with had a chat with Marcus Rashford about the penalty shootout, and he actually talked about how England were very open about their traumatic, shall we say, history of shootouts, and they sought to sort of kind of own that and use that as a positive. So it's like, you're England in a penalty shootout, the default is you will lose. That is what's expected. So you've actually got to start the chance to kind of write a different story, a more positive story. And in a way that, you know, the pressure, the failings of the past kind of take away the pressures of the future, and it's a chance to write a new chapter. And Rashford actually says that, you know, he's taken this penalty, England of 2-1 down in the shootout, and he said how Jordan Pickford just gave me the ball, we use that routine as something to settle us down, so it felt like it was how when we practice. So again, that's a difference with what we talked about before. And he said it felt like a normal situation, you know, and that is not that was not for a previous shootout. So again, those little tiny details, like with Pickford helping to kind of control the players' emotions before they're about to take the kicks, such an important thing. And yeah, it's replicating the pressure of a shootout as opposed to just the technical skill of taking penalties where it doesn't really matter. There's lots of ways you can, you know, you can introduce some pressure. You know, footballers obviously are very, very competitive. So even if you have kind of competitive shootouts at the end of training and so on, well, that's again, it's not the pressure of a World Cup, obviously, but it's some pressure, and it's better than nothing. And England were practicing this for months and months before, which is a real difference to that kind of that lottery mindset, which is a get out of jail free card as well.
Yeah, and then just another fact why my sporting career foundered very early on in my youth.
God, I feel I've been a bit of a therapist for you here.
No, well, I was going to say that I'm not left-footed, and as your book shows, left-footed players are more likely to score penalties.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually have a chapter on left-handers' advantage in general, and basically you get a big advantage because you're less familiar, because 90% of people are right-handed. So left-handed, you pose a different problem, and so you're likely to kind of face opponents who don't know quite what to do, and that gives you a big advantage. But yeah, even with penalty shootouts, again, goalkeepers, you know, they're going to spend the vast amount of time practicing for right footers, so they're better at identifying kind of cues from right footers. So if you're a left footer, that gives you another little edge, certainly.
One person I have come to terms with my sporting career now, but one person who took longer to come to terms with his lack of a sporting career was David Foster Wallace. We were talking about one of his essays, the title of which escapes me now, but we were chatting about it on a previous episode of this podcast with Caitlin Thompson, and he, in said essay, David Foster Wallace explained that his failure to make it as a pro tennis player was his first introduction to what he called adult sadness, that actually maybe the world is not built just for me and my whims, and not doesn't just revolve around me. David Foster Wallace writing about tennis is the second of your choices as well for us, Tim. Tell us a little bit about the essay String Theory that appeared in Esquire.
Yeah, it's an incredible detailed look at what it takes to be an elite tennis player. And it, in some ways, it's kind of better because the player is Michael Joyce, who's not particularly famous player. His ranking was sort of 50, 100. So he's sort of not what we would think of as a sort of super elite. But obviously, you know, to be the 50th best in the world at anything is absolutely amazing. And it, I guess it distills what goes into to doing that, and also the kind of a bit of the loneliness of the kind of singles player on tour, which is, you know, pretty brutal. And it's, I guess it's more brutal if you're not winning most tournaments. It's the kind of the slog, and it's the, yeah, and also just the art of tennis and particular shots, and just I guess the level of sacrifice that goes into this, the level of obsessiveness and just perfectionism. And also all of that, and knowing it's not really going to be rewarded with winning Grand Slams and so on. So there's a kind of, there's a bittersweet sense of the article as well.
Yeah, it does engage with what we were talking earlier about early specialization, you know, because David Foster Wallace always seems kind of offended by how boring sports people are. I don't know, there's another essay that he's written about picking up Tracy Austin's autobiography, and he was really looking forward to it and then realized this is one of the most boring books I've ever read. And I don't think he's ever fully, he's never fully got over that. And like, there's a line in here that I've picked out from the essay String Theory. "We prefer not to consider closely the shockingly vapid and primitive comments uttered by athletes in post-contest interviews, or to consider what impoverishments in one's mental life would allow people actually to think the way great athletes seem to think. Note the way up close and personal profiles of professional athletes strain so hard to find evidence of a rounded human life. Outside interests and activities, values beyond the sport. We ignore what's obvious, that most of this training is a farce. It's farce because the realities of top-level athletes today require an early and total commitment to one area of excellence, an ascetic focus, a subsumption of almost all other features of human life to one chosen talent and pursuit, a consent to live in a world that, like a child's world, is very small." I read that and I don't feel so bad about not making it as an athlete.
You don't need to be embittered anymore.
No, I think I've fully worked through. I think we're 40 minutes in here and I've fully worked through.
Well, I'm glad I've served some purpose.
When you were researching the book, like, did you fall into that kind of thinking? You know, like, why would you dedicate yourself to this kind of life? Or were you full of admiration, or was there much jealousy there?
Good question. I think it's a combination of all of the above, really, like a sense of how extraordinary it is, but also, you know, there's so many elite athletes who we don't hear of because they get injured at the wrong time or whatever, and so they put all this in, and it leads to nothing. Obviously, such a brutal industry, and actually, in terms of happiness, which is something we don't really talk about a lot with athletes, but we know that athletes are more likely to suffer from perfectionism and seem to actually suffer from depression more as well. So there's not, you don't, yeah, I wouldn't say my feeling was I wish I'd been one, which was never remotely on the cards for me anyway, but a sense of the kind of abnormality of it as a kind of profession, and the, I guess, how volatile it is as well, because so much can go wrong, and you're always kind of playing with fire.
One other thing I want to pick out from the David Foster Wallace essay is when he talks about Andre Agassi, and he talks about his vision. A certain kind of vision is crucial, and the vision is basically to be able to see shots and return them with the pace and the accuracy that Agassi does. And this, I absolutely love this section of your book where you explain that athletes use, as you said earlier, athletes use their eyes differently to us in the sense that they're more concentrated on, especially in those moments like rugby kickers lining up a shot and so on, but they don't actually see any better than us. Like, their vision actually isn't sharper than ours.
Yeah, so that certainly is one of the kind of myths that, you know, you often hear this, like, their eyes have gone, or, you know, it's the eyes, you know, it's all in the eyes and stuff. And that doesn't seem true at all. And I suppose, yeah, looking at tennis is a great example of this, is that you can't, if you have a ball being served at you at 150 miles an hour, the idea of, like, the kind of common advice you hear in basically all bat and ball sports, which is like, watch the ball, you should watch it like onto your racket or bat in cricket or baseball, like, that's actually not good advice because it's physically impossible to do. You have to be second guessing all the time. And what athletes, you know, so in tennis are able to do so well is they are able to use cues to get ahead of where the ball is going to go. So, you know, cues from their opponents, their hips, the kind of angle of their legs and their knees, how they start to hit the ball. And that all means that they can deduce where the ball is going to go basically before it's been hit, and that is buying them a bit more time, because you can't, if you wait until your opponent has hit the ball, it'll be then too late to start your movement again.
Like, the line you use in the book, and I loved it, is that, you know, it's just their perceptive skills are better. Like, they're almost like Poirot's, you know, they're like Agatha Christie, like characters in an Agatha Christie novel, where they can just read the clues and put everything together so much quicker than the rest of us.
Yeah, and there's this incredible study in baseball which shows this sort of better than anything else. So baseball, you have kind of 0.4 to 0.5 seconds between the ball being thrown by the pitcher and it hitting your or missing your bat. 0.4, 0.5 seconds. And in Japan, they did this nuts study, which is amazing, which is basically hitters had to wear goggles. And these goggles would turn them blind for 0.15 seconds before the pitch would arrive at them. So that's like the last third of the pitch's journey, effectively. And when they were blind for 150 milliseconds before the pitch arrived at them, it made no difference at all to how well they hit the ball. Which basically says that last bit of the journey, it's too late if the ball does something then. And it's all about what you can do before to put yourself in the best position. So that's really good. So the advice, the idea of watch the ball being the advice, it's the wrong advice. Yeah, it's about being the Poirot and finding out those clues and working out how you can give yourself the best possible chance and acting early and decisively.
And in tennis, I did like you talk about why tennis players grunt and scream when they hit the ball. And I assumed it allowed them to get more strength on their shot. And I think that's partly true. But it's also to obscure some of the clues for the other player. Because, as you explain, one of the clues in which an opposing tennis player will know as to where the shot is going to drop is the sound the ball makes off the racket. And by screaming, you can occlude that sound and you can gain like a millisecond advantage. And that actually can make a difference at the very top level.
Yeah, and this is if you want to be really unpopular on the tennis court and start winning some more games, this is the best advice, which is that you should grunt really, really hard on your drop shots, because then your opponent will anticipate you're hitting it really, really, really deep and really hard. And then they'll be stumped when they realize it's a drop shot, it'll be too late. And you should not grunt at all when you do hit the ball as hard as possible. That would be a real way of kind of disorientating your opponents.
Yeah, we'll go from grunting to singing the ballad of Lauris Karius, because he is one of the players in the 2018 Champions League final. And Jonathan Liu wrote a fantastic piece for The Independent about said final. And it's your third pick. Tell us why you picked this one.
So the other two pieces were kind of obviously very long pieces and, you know, had the benefit of, you know, time to think about how they were done and, you know, a lot of a lot of access to the people that they wanted to talk to. And this is a written, basically is written on the whistle, and it captures the emotions of the occasion in an amazing way. And yeah, the quality of writing this is amazing, but it really captures the drama of that game, and the sort of, you know, the almost tragic elements of what happened with Liverpool when they had this amazing campaign to reach the final, and then this goalkeeper has this chance in the sun, you know, maybe to be a year's, you know, what happened with Dudek in 2005, where you have this kind of goalkeeper who's at the top of career and then goes on to win the Champions League and be the hero. Well, for Karius, it's the exact opposite, and it's, you know, he never plays for Liverpool again, and it's obvious, you know, at the time he'll never play for Liverpool again. But this piece, it captures that, and it captures this sort of tension between what he talks about, you know, the madness of Liverpool and the kind of orderly, I guess, the power and the kind of order and structure of Real Madrid, and it kind of captures that contrast and what this game means to so many people in a fantastic way.
Yeah, I've just picked out one paragraph to quote. There's a strange, elusive magic to football stadiums in the hours before a big game. You can't touch or taste or smell or hear the eruption, but somehow you can sense it. You couldn't yet picture Mohamed Salah crying with anguish on the turf, Gareth Bale flying through the night sky like a comet, Lloris Karius grasping at the ball like a man trying to catch snow, but you could feel its heft in the void that preceded it. There's a potential there, an implication, a tautness and an emptiness. The bigger the game, the bigger the emptiness. And that's certainly how it felt for Lloris Karius, who made two utter clangers, like two of the worst individual errors you'll ever see in a game of that magnitude. And he made it in a final to cost Liverpool the European Cup. Like, Liverpool were back a year later and they won it, but Karius was the odd man out. He'd left the club at that point, and they won thanks to the fact that they improved the goalkeeper, which just goes to show how cutthroat it is. When you were looking on, and now with the bank of knowledge that you've built up, Tim, from writing this book, when you looked at Karius, did you see shortcomings other than technical shortcomings? Because they were fairly obvious when he was throwing the ball into his own net.
Yeah, well, the other thing you'd point to without knowing his training is whether he'd kind of been exposed to enough high pressure moments in training. So, you know, we talked with sort of Leon Del Don, Steph Curry, you know, Dan Carter about their practice methods, and they talked about how they try to make their practice harder than the game itself, through doing things like, you know, practicing very hard things when they're as tired as possible, through doing things like, you know, you can be, well, with Leon Del Don, she tries to make sure she shoots 10 in a row before she stops. So that's under pressure. She shoots her three throws when she's as tired as possible at the end of her training. And so these are all kind of things you can do. I suppose those are other things that I guess all players can always do a bit more of. But I think, as much as I say all that, there is also a certain element of you can give yourself the best possible chance, and absolutely you should do that. But I also think you can do all that, and occasionally athletes will still choke, which is kind of what's happened with Karius. And we actually have a chapter in the book on choking. And I suppose essentially what happens is anxiety kind of reaches a point where it stymies actions that used to be natural from it. They basically become conscious, athletes become conscious as they're doing them. So it's almost like you have to think about how you walk. It's kind of a real life equivalent when you wouldn't normally have to think about that. And this anxiety kind of clouds kind of clear thinking, which gets in the way of performance. And so I suppose, yeah, a very good example of how to stop that happening would be when Tiger Woods was a kid, actually. His dad would, when he had a big putt, so his dad would jingle coins and stuff and kind of be as annoying as possible on purpose, which is really, really good, because it's almost practicing someone trying to put him off and distract him at a key putt. And it means actually you might not get that distraction if you're playing in an open, and actually then that can become a little bit easier. So that those are some of the things that you can do to make yourself less susceptible to choking.
just one quick listener question in for you, Tim, from Dermot, who asks, how much has sports science contributed to making modern athletes into elite athletes? Or is it still a case of genetics, relentless training and self-belief that accelerates talent to the very top of the pile?
Yes, that's a good question. I think sports science, obviously, it's improved the quality of training, which is a really important thing. So we're seeing things like virtual reality being used, for example, to improve the mind, actually, and sharpen decision making. So that's a really important thing. We're seeing kind of sports science being used to emphasize kind of more basic things, but improve them. A really good example of that is sleep. So there's really good studies show, you know, athletes sleep 8 hours a night, they tend to perform better as well. Well, that's, you know, we might have thought that already, but by being able to prove that, you actually encourage athletes themselves to stick to that and kind of emphasize that the point and the message to them more. So yeah, there's clearly, like, what I would say is that the best athletes probably seem further removed from the rest of us than ever before, because they have, by being exposed to, you know, this brilliant training, brilliant coaching and the quality of sports science, it means that when they're kind of professional, they then can jump even higher. And it's almost as if they now exist in a different kind of ecosystem to the rest of us.
Our final two questions, Tim, we throw them at everyone. Where is the most interesting place that work has brought you?
I will go for Barbados, I think, which is a fantastic country and amazing place. And I don't think needs much more to be said on it.
Cricket is a good beat. And lastly, the most interesting person that you've met through work.
So Steve Kerr was fantastic to meet and chat to. We chatted to him for the book. And I guess some of you would have seen Steve on The Last Dance as a kind of very important supporting actor to the Michael Jordan show there. But he's an incredible, I think for a coach, what really came across was his intelligence, obviously, but his kind of empathy and kind of understanding of athletes and actually sort of so far removed from the kind of caricature of the head coach who, you know, shouts at players and throws his boot, you know, throws boots at them and so on. So he's a complete, a very, very modern coach in that sense. And kind of his emotional intelligence really is, I think, crucial in, you know, him being such an effective coach.
Yeah. Well, Tim Wigmore, that was fascinating chat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Cheers, Gavin. Really enjoyed that.
Thanks very much to Tim, and thanks to you as ever for listening to the show and supporting our work here at The 42. You can get in touch with us, email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can find me on Twitter, I'm at gcooney93, or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of the podcast. That is it for another episode of Behind the Line. We will, as ever, be back next week with another great guest. But until then, take it easy.